Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to Paris for an update on the investigations into the coordinated massacres that took place on Friday night across the city at restaurants, a concert hall, and at a sports stadium. François d'Alençon, a foreign correspondent with the French daily La Croix, who was formerly the newspaper's foreign editor and Middle East correspondent, joins us to discuss the traumatic events that have put the country on a war footing against a threat that cannot be solved by military means alone. As President Hollande is pressured to take a hard line by Sarkozy on his right and Le Pen on his far right, we will examine what can be done to detect potential terrorists before they attack without undermining liberté, égalité, and fraternité. Then we'll look further into what Hollande means when he announces that war has been declared on France and that in response he will be merciless. The editor-in-chief of Insurge Intelligence and a weekly columnist for Middle East Eye, Nafiz Ahmed, joins us from London to analyze the strategy of the self-declared Islamic State to bait the West, they call crusaders, into scapegoating Muslims and driving a wedge between the Muslim diaspora in Europe and the rest of the population, while at the same time U.S. policies have added to the number of failed states in which these jihadists have safe haven and can build their so-called caliphate. Then finally, we'll examine the rhetoric and recriminations coming from the G20 meeting in Turkey, where discussions are underway to try to end the civil war in Syria, which is causing an exodus of refugees to Europe that an EU spokesman is blaming Russia for exacerbating by bombing the country in support of the Assad regime. A former senior CIA official, Graham Fuller, the author of Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East, joins us to discuss the problem with direct links to the fate of Syria, Iraq, and Turkey itself, and that is the Kurdish question, now made all the more urgent since Turkey's President Erdogan cynically reignited a war against the Turks to win the recent election. And joining us now from Paris, France, is François d'Alençon, who is a foreign correspondent with the French daily newspaper La Croix. Based in Paris, he was formerly the foreign news editor at La Croix and has covered the Middle East extensively. Welcome to Background Briefing, François d'Alençon.
Good morning.
So obviously at this point, there's some more evidence coming to light vis-a-vis the horrible coordinated massacres that took place a couple of days ago in Paris. A car has been found with a number of assault rifles in it. There have been arrests in Belgium, but there's a sense that there's an eighth person on the run. What's the latest on the idea that there may be somebody that got away, that perhaps drove the getaway car?
Well, I'm not so familiar with the latest information from on the side of the Minister of Interior and of the Public Prosecutor. But yes, there is this Belgium side of the operation, which appears to be quite meaningful. There was a conversation between the French Ministry of Interior and his Belgium counterpart, and the French Ministry of Interior, has requested a meeting at the European level with his colleagues from the European Union countries. So, yes. The Belgium connection is meaningful, and there is this. It was already the case in the previous attack in January, and you have a big area, famous area of Brussels, where those people have apparently a sort of net, and that's where the Belgian police has been operating since yesterday.
Well, apparently the area surrounds a mosque that preaches a very radical jihadist kind of dogma. And that's pretty surprising that it would be so identifiable. Give us a picture, if you will, François, of what is going on in the Paris suburbs. Obviously, one of the jihadists murdered all of those people has been identified. Ismail Omar Mostafi, a 29-year-old who lived originally in Chartres and then in southwest of Paris. And there's also other evidence in the suburb of Montreux. So give me a sense of the picture of, are there equivalents in Paris to what appears to be a fairly clear example of a meeting place for radicals in Brussels?
Well, I'm not sure that it is the case in France, because those places have been identified since a long time, and we are in a totally different kind of situation in France right now. I mean, this is a new wave of jihadism, and I don't think it has to be described as, you know, people would be radicalized around that mosque or that place. You have a huge population of people, of young people, who have done the trip to Syria. And so this is not the same scale, and this is not the same type of radicalization. Sometimes those people are self-recruited on internet. There is a part of romanticism, nihilism, of joining the jihadist adventure in Syria. And so for the police and the services, it's quite a big net, a big population in size, and it has been very difficult to follow such a huge number. We are talking about several thousand, something like 8,000 people were on this list of potential. But I want to emphasize the word potential. People who could one day commit an act of terrorism, it's a different size, and for the police and the Ministry of Interior in France, they are a bit, I think, overwhelmed by the size of the phenomenon since the beginning of the Syrian crisis.
And again, I'm speaking with François Dalasson, who is a foreign correspondent with the French daily newspaper La Croix. He's based in Paris and was formerly the foreign news editor at La Croix and has covered the Middle East extensively. But just back to the one of the attackers that was identified, Ismail Omar Mostafi, this 29-year-old who lived in Chartres, southwest of Paris. He apparently visited Syria a year or two ago for an extensive period. My understanding is that up to 2,000 French citizens have left France to go to fight jihad in Syria, and about 250 have returned. What system does the French government have for those returning? Because, for example, the Russians, who are not exactly big on civil liberties, they simply won't allow anybody to come back from Syria. So what is the French policy when people come back after? Because it's pretty clear that these assailants probably had military training and military experience fighting in Syria. I think that's not too hard to imagine, is it?
Yeah, well, until now, the policy was obviously to watch and to follow, to watch these people. But if you have a free circulation of people, and if a French citizen comes back from any trip abroad, obviously it would be first of all very difficult if you don't know whether he went to Syria. Will not know when he comes back into the so-called Schengen zone, the European Customs Agreement. Within, coming back from France through a plane taken in a different country of Europe would not automatically trigger something in the French police. But And second, if you cannot start an investigation if you don't have any proof of this person, this individual being involved in some kind of terrorist enterprise, even abroad. So until now, those people were under watch. If they are detected when they come back, but otherwise, that's all they can. The police and the services could do. The second issue is for the what will happen in the future with those people, because obviously after the events of last Friday, you have people voices asking the same question and requesting more drastic measures and preventive action against those people who have been to Syria. So I don't want to prejudge about what the government could do or propose to do in terms of new legislation regarding those people. It might or might not happen, but legally speaking, in terms of what is possible or not, I think there are limits. There are limits, and I would be a bit difficult. You would have to really have some kind of proof of some terrorist association for that kind of individual. Otherwise, there is this. We have the European Convention of Human Rights would apply, and even and French law as well, and it would be very difficult to arrest people like this without any real proof of even preparation of involvement in preparation of a terrorist act.
Well, going back to the Charlie Hebdo attacks, apparently the authorities had those two Kouachi brothers under surveillance for some time. And mm-hmm. then they decided to move their focus to others who they thought were more dangerous. And then, of course, what happened was that they were able to participate in the attack because they were no longer under surveillance. And one of them turned out to be married. And his wife was able, after the attack, to somehow escape France and end up in Syria. So it seems like these networks are fairly well organized. Is that your sense?
You know, organized. I mean, the wife didn't commit any crime. So,
right.
I mean, you cannot arrest the wife only because she's the wife of the person who committed the, you know, you can arrest her to interrogate her maybe and arrest her on a temporary basis for this interrogation, but then if she was not involved in any, it's difficult. Anyway, in that case, if I remember, she left before, not after.
Right.
So I mean, I don't see any issue with the police or the what should have been done, because her escape to Syria was organized before the act. I mean, before the terrorist act. They want to Spain, if I remember, and she went to Spain with one of the brother and or one of the relatives, and they took a plane in Madrid to Istanbul and then went to Syria. Anyway, no, you know, the networks, obviously, the problem is there is a sort of new quantitative dimension to the problem, and it has, I must say, there is an issue, and that's probably going to be discussed in the next few days in France about the current capacity in terms of personnel, of staff, of the people involved in this, in watching those people, because, I mean, with this huge pool of potential terrorists, it's a bit difficult, and police and the justice systems are overwhelmed. There was an interview a few months ago by the French judge in charge of terrorism, who left his position a few months ago. He said, we will not be able to prevent what I see is coming, a massive attack, because there are simply too many people to watch. And there is this obvious question of whether the latest improvement in terms of staff and budget decided by the current government has been enough or not.
Well, there is, though, a kind of similarity in the backgrounds and the sort of journey, if you will, of these young jihadists who seem to be alienated, living in the Paris suburbs. Many of them, including the one that has been identified in this attack, were petty criminals, and it's difficult to know at what point they go from crime to terrorism. But that seems to be a sort of common thread. When the authorities said recently, the Attorney General's talking about there was a curfew and there have been a lot of arrests. What's your sense of when President Hollande said that Daesh, the so-called self-declared Islamic State, have declared war on us? He's almost implying, isn't he, that we're declaring war back? What's your sense of Hollande's challenge is?
Yeah, there is a huge challenge for the president, because there is not much else he can do in terms of military, action. You can always improve the information, the collection of information, the surveillance system, etc. This is the key, but this is not something which sells very, very well, and it's rather and it goes unnoticed. You can announce an increase in the budget, you can announce recruitment of people, you can announce... So there is pressure, obviously, on the current president to be tough. There is the electoral context with the regional elections coming in December. You have the presidential election, which will take place in 2017. So you have a lot of competition on the political scene coming from the right side of the political spectrum, with the former president Nicolas Sarkozy asking for a totally new approach in terms of both domestic and foreign policy. You have Marine Le Pen exploiting the new, the situation for her own sake. So, yes, for Hollande, this is quite a challenge. And until now, his response has been to, use the so-called military instrument or response by, sending troops, for example, in Africa to go after the terrorists in Sub-Sahara, or, announcing the involvement of the French aircrafts into the coalition over Iraq and Syria. And every time there was this communication, political communication, about the war on terror, about the fight between good and evil, not unlike the rhetoric that you in the U.S. have experienced after the attack in September in 9/11. So, and with the Bush, the W. Bush administration. So, in that respect, maybe this willingness and this very warrior rhetoric may reach its limits, because I don't think you can eradicate the so-called barbarians only by military means. I mean, you go after a jihadist through a variety of tools, but what is lacking, of course, in that case, is the political side of the response, the long-term strategy in terms of, you know, going after those people and the ideology, going after also in terms of social disconnect and, say, what you mentioned, the social economic condition in the suburbs, you know, mostly the response would be to give a job to these people. It means improving the economy, the French economy, and in that respect, the current government has not done very well, as you know. The unemployment is above 10% in France, and in those suburbs, the unemployment is often between 20 and 30%. So. You can imagine that with this kind of social economic environment, with those youngsters without jobs and involved in petty crimes or drug dealers, the path towards jihadism is something attractive, and you don't solve this issue only by military means and even counter-terrorism. It's a mix of different instruments, and what is lacking obviously, on the French side is the political tools, the economic tools.
Sure. Well, François d'Alençon, I thank you so much for joining us. And I guess we'll just wait and see what François Hollande meant by he will be merciless in his response. But we appreciate your time here today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with François d'Alençon, who's a foreign correspondent with the French daily La Croix. He's based in Paris and was formerly the foreign news editor at La Croix and has covered the Middle East extensively. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into what President Hollande means when he announced that war has been declared on France and that in response he will be merciless. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now from London is Nafis Ahmed, who is a best-selling author, international security scholar, and investigative journalist. He's the editor-in-chief of Insurgent Intelligence at medium.com and writes for Vice's science and technology magazine Motherboard and is a weekly columnist for Middle East Eye. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nafis Ahmed.
Thank you, Ian. Thanks for having me on.
And Nafis, when the French president says he's going to be merciless in his response, saying that Daesh, this so-called self-declared Islamic State, have declared war in France, he's implying that they're declaring war back. But when he says that our response will be merciless, You have written about warning about an uncontrollable rage in response to these outrageous acts. You know, the word barbarianism and barbarians is being bandied about now by politicians and the press. So it seems like we're going into a kind of reflexive mode. What do you think Hollande is talking about when he talks about a merciless response?
Well, I think he obviously, I mean, his reaction is understandable. He needs to basically, he needs to reassure the public that he will take all necessary actions to ensure that this doesn't happen again. And so he does need to make a very kind of clear stance. And I think that's what he's trying to do. The only problem is that in a way we've kind of been down this road before. And that really is the problem, is that if we look at what's happening in Paris in isolation and think about it as this act of war that's come out of the blue, in a way, some of what Hollande said echoes things that President George W. Bush said after 9/11, you know, that this is people who hate our way of life and hate our freedoms. And of course, they do. But that's not the only thing at stake here. It's a lot more complicated than that. And I think that's the problem, is that Bush's response after 9/11 was very similar, in the sense that we had, you know, this war. This is a declaration of war, so now we're going to go to war. And since then, you know, as everyone knows, you know, we've had a decade and a half of perpetual war. And far from defeating terrorism, what we've seen actually is that the number of terrorist attacks has multiplied, that Al-Qaeda has metamorphosed into and given birth to this Frankenstein monster that we see, this entity which has state aspirations and which actually controls huge swathes of territory larger than several countries. So this really, to me, demonstrates something very important that I would really hope that Hollande and other world leaders take note of, which is that actually, you know, if we continue with the same stale policies that we've implemented so far, we are only going to make things a lot worse rather than making them better. And what we really need is to kind of step back and have a little bit of introspection and reflection on how exactly a group like ISIS has been able to come about and has been able to have the success that it's had.
Well, clearly it would be, I think, part of Daesh or ISIS's strategy to drive a wedge between the Muslim community in Europe and in the diaspora and the countries in which they live. That is a part of their strategy. So the question is, you know, how much are the European countries and even the United States, by extension, going to fall into that trap? I mean, that was bin Laden. He baited Bush and Cheney into saying, come and get me, you know, come put Christian crusader armies on Muslim soil. I mean, and of course, Bush and Cheney took the bait. That seems to
absolutely
be...
Absolutely.
Isn't that the MO of these characters?
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at, there's been various publications, in the only English language publication, which ISIS put out every so often, and this, they wrote, and they had a feature article which came out shortly after the Charlie Hebdo attacks, and they actually very explicitly refer to this strategy exactly as you've described it, Ian. They speak about the need to eliminate the gray zone between these two camps, which they call, you know, the Crusader Kuffar camp of the West and everyone who's with them, and the camp of ISIS. And what's interesting is that it's not just targeted at, what we might traditionally say is the kuffar, is the disbelievers or non-Muslims. It's targeted at Muslims who actually reject ISIS. And it has a whole screed about the need to basically kill apostates and target Muslims who are standing in solidarity with the victims of Charlie Hebdo and things like that. And they explicitly say that their aim is to actually eliminate this gray zone. And what's very disturbing is they actually quite clearly set out that they want to create conditions within Western countries. So they actually specifically talk about the diaspora, and they say we want these conditions to be much more heightened persecution so that Muslims feel that they can't anymore live inside the West, and they begin to do what they call hijra, migration, to the Islamic State. And it's all part of this very apocalyptic end-time vision of what they see being this kind of this end-of-the-world clash between good and evil. And what we need to do is not fall into that trap, because in a way, it's ironic that the neoconservatives have always been ideological allies in a way with this very extremist Islamist militant vision. I mean, and in this same article, they actually quote Osama bin Laden endorsing the words of President Bush when he said, "You're either with us or against us." And he actually said, "Yes, this is absolutely correct. You're either you're with us or you're with the Crusaders." And that's what they're trying to do. And I think the danger of what Hollande has done in terms of the measures that he's taking is there's a danger that it's going to basically create that division, which is either you're with us or against us. Either you're with the state, you're with the French state, and you support everything that they do, or you're on the side of the extremists and the militants and the terrorists. And that is a very, very dangerous thing, because in reality, this gray zone, this area, which I think the vast majority of people stand in, they don't support violence of any kind. They're not happy with indiscriminate drone strikes in Pakistan and Afghanistan and Yemen, and they're not happy with ISIS and Al-Qaeda either. And they don't particularly subscribe to any of these kind of policies on either side. And I think it's very important that we recognize that gray zone, which is not actually a gray zone, is actually that is where the commonality of humanity really is. And that's what we need to be cherishing and need to be standing together on.
And our previous guest from Paris was pointing out that military means alone cannot solve this problem, and that an eye for an eye response will actually exacerbate it. And pointing out, of course, that in the suburbs surrounding Paris, from where a lot of these young recruits, we're not entirely sure where they came from, some of these attackers, they do seem to have some military training, and that would indicate that they'd perhaps fought, came, you know, a battle hardened coming from Syria. But he pointed out that, you know, the 20-30% unemployment, etc., these are the issues that also have to be addressed. But what about, since the point has already been made that military means alone will not solve this problem, obviously at its root there is a religious ideology, albeit somewhat nihilistic. But it's not that different from Wahhabism. And my sense is that the Saudis have got to step up here. And I'm not sure about, I mean, in a curious way, ISIS or the Daesh are saying that they're going to be the new caliphate. And they're threatening the legitimacy of the House of Saud as custodians of Mecca and Medina. And they want to march in there like the Wahhabis did over 100 years ago. So are there analogies here, and do you think that at its root we've got to address who and what has radicalized Islam to the extent that the Wahhabis and the Islamic State have?
I think absolutely. I mean, we definitely need to tackle all of these issues. And the most important thing really is that we don't reduce the problem to one thing. And that's the tendency that we see from different interests, depending on who they are. So you'll have some people who say it's all about ideology. It's nothing to do with anything else. It's just about religious extremism. That's the issue. And then obviously, you know, you have people who go even further and say it's not just a minority radicalized interpretation of Islam. It is Islam. And you'll get people to go to that extent. Then you'll have other people who say, no, it's not religion. It's just foreign policy. It's just grievances. Or it's just, you know, injustice and socioeconomic issues. And the reality is that actually it's all of these things combined, and it's really the way in which these things interact that creates such a fatal cocktail and which allows groups like this to thrive. And if we go back, it's really important that we go back and recognize that over the last 20 years, and we see that, you know, a group like ISIS did not exist before the Iraq War. The Iraq War laid the conditions of instability that kind of laid the groundwork that allowed these Islamist ideologies to come in. But at the same time, if it wasn't for the ideologies, if it wasn't for the combination of finances and material support to this extremist ideology, and not just one ideology, but, you know, a mix of various extremist groups who were operating at the time, if that didn't happen, then this wouldn't have come about in the way it did. Because in the day, you know, we're not talking about creation ex nihilo. You know, this is, you know, the groups don't just appear out of nowhere. There has to be a material context to this. And I think the material context is something that is often missing from these debates, which is really, where did, you know, follow the money. Where did the money come from? What were the geopolitics that allowed this group to come into play? So, of course, we see the destabilization of Iraq, the destabilization of Syria, you know, Assad's war on his own people. We know, we can see that this laid the groundwork. The question then is, where did these extremist groups come from and how did they get so prominent and powerful? And I do think that there is a very important question mark here about the role of many of our allies in this so-called anti-ISIS coalition, who we know from very credible intelligence sources and other reports that they have been financing Islamist militants. They've been financing Al-Qaeda. They've been financing groups that have, and they've even been financing ISIS. And we know this from various declassified reports that have emerged, that I reported on, for example, that came out from the Defense Intelligence Agency in 2012. We know this from testimony from senior U.S. military and other Pentagon officials who've spoken about this in Senate and in Congress and acknowledged that, yes, actually, you know, during the anti-Assad drive that the West was backing, you know, the Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the UAE, Turkey, Kuwait, and some other countries were pouring millions of dollars, if not billions, into supporting their favored groups in order to topple Assad. And it got to the point where they were financing, you know, al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda affiliated group, financing al-Qaeda in Iraq. And the problem is that, you know, the United States and Britain and France kind of sat back at this time and thought this was the right thing to do. Now, whatever we make of that decision and the very short-sighted nature of it, that this has happened. And those countries like Saudi Arabia have exported through this mechanism this very virulent ideology. Without that money, I don't think that a group like ISIS would ever have been able to come about and become so powerful. And so we need to then think, if we're going to tackle this issue, we have to think very long and hard about who our allies are currently at the moment. So, you know, we have a lot of talk about Iran and, you know, sanctions on, you know, we've now got past the stage of sanctions on Iran and solved this nuclear issue. But there are bigger question marks, I think, about countries like Saudi, countries like Turkey, for instance, where we've seen that there is evidence that Turkey has been covertly sponsoring Islamist militant groups in Syria in its eagerness to topple Assad. And I think that's really what strikes at the core of the problem with the current strategy. If we continue on the path of, you know, let's just fight back with war and airstrikes and all the rest of it, while not addressing these other issues to do with that regional geopolitics, who these other countries are that are feeding this mess, and our relationships with those countries, you know, we're not going to be able to solve this problem. It will only get worse. And that's actually what's happened over the last decade and a half.
Well, Nafees Ahmed, you mentioned a deadly cocktail. I think into the mix that you just told us about, the culpability of Saudis and Saudi money, you have to also add to that that, first of all, it was a failed state, Afghanistan, where bin Laden was able to operate. And then the U.S. went in to get him. And all they've essentially done, is make a failed state even more of a failed state after spending trillions and getting nowhere. Bush and Cheney intervened in Iraq. It was a war of choice. They've turned that into a failed state. Syria has become a failed state as a result of, in many ways, the Syrian uprising was sparked by creating a failed state in Libya. So, as long as you keep creating failed states, you literally are providing a breeding ground for the very terrorism that you're trying to eradicate.
Exactly. And I think that's precisely, I mean, that gets to the heart of the foreign policy issue here, that it's not even just about the grievances that groups like ISIS will air about, you know, the interventions of the West, but it's the reality that actually, you know, we've had this string of continual interventions under the war on terror, which have quite literally and quite directly laid the ground for these groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS to become much stronger and much more potent than they ever would have been before then. And this really speaks to fundamental questions about the military-industrial complex and the overbearing power of these interests that have made the most profit from these wars. I mean, if you look at Cheney, Bush, and you look at the various people in the administration and their connections with various defense companies, there is a very, very clear pattern of these defense companies coming in like vultures, essentially, you know, taking huge amounts of taxpayers' money, and then using that, you know, they're then taking that money as profit in the name of reconstruction contracts. They're not actually doing meaningful reconstruction or development on the ground. In fact, as you've said, you know, what we're seeing is these conditions in these countries are worsening dramatically. Infrastructure is collapsing. You know, sort of public services are collapsing, and in that context, we have these, you know, this very predatory process of international companies and foreign investors coming in and reaping the benefits and then pulling their capital out to take their profits with them. I mean, this speaks to how deep this problem goes. That it's a combination of so many different things. You've got the ideology, you've got the geopolitics, and you've got this economics. You've got the reality that we have a predatory capitalism where there are these special interests which, probably not even thinking about the consequences of what they're doing, but simply trying to minimize their costs and maximize their profits, which is a perfectly rational thing to do within this current system. I think that's the problem. It goes so much deeper than that. But it does mean that if we really want to solve this problem, there needs to be a much deeper level of introspection that looks at how and why our policies in the war on terror have failed so dramatically. Mm-hmm. And actually, really, what we need is an international public inquiry of some kind that is led by, involved like an institution like the United Nations or something, which allows us to basically really scrutinize how these policies have come about and how they've failed so dramatically so that we can really do something about this. Because if we continue on our current course, it's only going to accelerate disaster.
Well, just in the last minute, the military-industrial complex, of course, get their money from the Congress, and the Congress throw money at them. They just threw $607 billion in the latest budget. My sense is, and you talk about the symbiosis between the neocons and the jihadists, the fact that these characters, this Daesh, Islamic State, executed Foley and a few other journalists and aid workers on television, that was the image that got America back into that war. Obama was trying to draw us out of that. And that's the nexus that I think you also have to break. It's the Congress who throws money at the military-industrial complex. They're just passive. They're just parasites. They just get the money. But you've got to stop the money. And the reason they give the money is that the public is susceptible to something like having somebody's throat cut on television, which in the overall scheme of things is nothing like the Soviet Union targeting every American city around the clock, being able to annihilate the entire planet in 30 minutes. We've had some real security threats in the past. This is not anything that rises to that level. So there's a lack of proportionality amongst the public, the press, and the politicians who throw money at the military-industrial complex.
I totally agree. I mean, I think if we go back to what was happening at that time with people like Foley and other victims, and we look at the response, and then we look at where we are today, there's no doubt that what we've done has made it worse. By going into Syria and Iraq in the way that we have done, and by adopting this approach with allies who have a very questionable background in relation to the very entities that we're supposed to be fighting. And we see the results in Paris. You know, it would have been unthinkable to see a Mumbai-style attack in Paris, you know, a year ago. To see it now happening and to see that this is the consequence, this is the result of the policy that we've had, really should cause a lot of people to start rethinking what they've done. And I can only hope that the people in Congress who have been throwing money at the military-industrial complex as if it's going to solve all our problems will now stop and think that, wait a minute, you know, this trajectory hasn't worked. It's not worked at all, and we need to have a fundamental rethink.
Well, Nafees Ahmed, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. I appreciate the opportunity.
And again, I've been speaking with Nafees Ahmed, who's a best-selling author, international security scholar, and investigative journalist. He's the editor-in-chief of Insurgent Intelligence at Medium.com. He writes for Vice's science and technology magazine, Motherboard, and is a weekly columnist for Middle East Eye. And we're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the G20 meeting in Turkey and the Kurdish question, now made all the more urgent since Turkey's President Erdogan cynically reignited a war against the Kurds to win the recent election. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Graham Fuller, the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East. And his latest book is Breaking Faith, a novel of espionage and an American's crisis of conscience in Pakistan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Graham Fuller.
Thank you, Ian. It's always a pleasure.
And Graham, just in, I wanted to talk about the G20 meeting underway in Turkey, but you wrote a piece recently basically saying that the Kurdish question has direct links to the fate of Syria, Iraq, and Turkey itself, and that the Kurdish question has been made all the more urgent since Turkey's President Erdogan cynically reignited a war against the Kurds to win the recent election. Now that he's got back in power and he's got all the marbles, if you will, is the bad guy going to be a good guy?
Well, one never knows in politics. Surprises always abound. But given his track record... Given his track record, I am not terribly confident that he is going to change his spots. He has become increasingly isolated, I think driven by delusions of grandeur, I think losing touch with reality in many respects and bent on putting his full stamp on the Turkish state under democratically elected authoritarianism, if you will. I don't think that he is likely to make breakthroughs with the Kurds, as he had once done, by the way, more than 5 years ago, had gone further than any other Turkish leader had done in approaching and engaging in dialogue with the Kurds. But he does have his legacy to think about. I don't know whether power is more important or legacy is more important. But returning to the Kurdish question, and now with his 4 years of under his belt, new 4 years, it's just possible he may do it. But I don't trust his instincts.
Well, presumably Turkey's MIT, their equivalent of the CIA, have their hands full now protecting all of the foreign leaders at the Mediterranean resort in Turkey. But you know, the MIT, that bombing in the Capitol happened quite close to the headquarters, and some suggested that the MIT may have had some fingerprints on it. But at the very least, the fact that it happened, and those peace demonstrators, mostly Kurds and liberals, were unprotected, I think, indicates a certain cynicism on the part, or at least it raises questions, surely.
Absolutely, it does. I wouldn't want to go so far, and neither do you, I think, in saying that Meat was behind this. But I think that they were not unhappy in advance, anyway, of thinking that this Kurdish and liberal movement demonstration might be subject to a lot of protests or even more violent actions by others. I don't think they remotely dreamed that it would go as far as it did. But, I mean, Erdogan is indeed responsible for backing away from his major strides towards settlement with the Kurds, but also the PKK, which is the leading Turkish-Kurdish guerrilla organization, which has been fighting over 25 years, a guerrilla war, and on and off in the East in particular, is not without blame either in this regard. They feel somewhat threatened by a new liberal left-of-center Kurdish movement called HDP, which has actually, because of its moderation and its filling a desperately needed hole in the left of the political spectrum, lots of liberal Turks also voted for it. So the PKK, which has adopted a far more radical and even violent agenda, had felt threatened by that as well, and that I think helped bring them back into the fray of violence.
Well, just touching on the Kurdish actors here, the Kurdish north of Iraq, at the moment the Peshmerga are. Have gone into Sinjar. They've cut the highway 47 that supplies Mosul from Raqqa, essentially cutting off the Islamic State in Mosul. But the extraordinary thing is that those Peshmerga fighters haven't been paid for about 3 months. And the excuse is that the price of oil has dropped. But you can't help feeling that Barzani is not handling this. And do you think there's going to be blowback against him?
Well, Barzani represents really the old guard of Iraqi Kurds and Kurdish movement. This goes back to the days of baronial fiefdoms in the Kurdish mountains. And the family, it's almost a dynasty, has been very important in Kurdish history and Kurdish nationalism. But it's, I think, been upstaged by more modern movements, including the PKK, which denounces the old feudalism of the Barzanis and even the Talibanis, and calling for a left-wing ideological approach to Kurdish nationalism rather than the old style. So I think, yeah, the pressure is growing on old style Kurdish politics, and that is partly maybe what this new HDP movement in Turkey represents. People who want to get on with the modern world and not with a feudal kind of nationalism. Our Barzani will be threatened by that with time.
Well, back to the G20 meeting, the president of the European Council, Donald Tusk, has accused Russia of increasing the number of refugees in Europe from Syria because of their support of the Assad regime and the bombing that's going on. What do you make of that?
Well, I have a fair degree of contempt for that remark. I think it's a rather cynical statement to suggest that suddenly, because Russia is now operating on the scene, that suddenly we've got refugees, and suddenly, as he and others also comment, even in Washington, comment, oh, well, now, you know, the Russians are actually killing civilians and this sort of thing. The U.S. has its hands drenched in blood, whether how intentionally or not, among civilian casualties. It's in the nature of war, and to point the finger at Russia, who's a new boy on the block in this regard, is, I find, quite cynical. The any movement that is going to push back ISIS and eliminate other jihadi movements that are fighting against Assad are going to create civilian casualties. It's going to make cities unlivable for considerable periods of time, and yes, it will increase the refugee flow. But this didn't begin with Russia. It began way, way, way back. I tend to feel right now that Russia may be actually part of the solution, and some in the Pentagon, I think, may be leaning in that direction as well. Maybe part of a solution, which means we've got to restore order, get back to a very unpleasant regime under Assad, but at least restore order, and then we'll sit down and talk about how to change the regime and its structure. I think actually with this recent ISIS attack in Europe, I think there will be much greater pressure on everybody to get in to clean up the region from the ISIS cancer, and indeed are going to demand that Assad himself cannot simply sit there and benefit from these actions in support of his regime, that he too is going to have to step down sooner rather than later, but the details to be negotiated.
Well, it seems that given that Obama and Russian President Vladimir Putin met on the sidelines and spoke for more than 30 minutes today at the G20 in Turkey, my sense is that Obama is actually being quite mature about this and letting the Russians, see what they can do. You know, it's not as if we've done much to bring about peace in Syria.
Well, I think you're right. I think the subject probably should have demanded more than 30 minutes of the time of both of them, but that's certainly better than nothing. I think Obama's instincts are in the right direction on this. He has not wanted to get drawn into this, and indeed I have felt that the U.S. should not get drawn into it. The game changer to me, and to obviously so many people, is suddenly now ISIS reaching out deep into Europe and creating mayhem and social chaos. That, I think, is going to change the way people are going to think, including the use of external violence. The West, and especially the U.S., has a miserable record of trying to fix anything in the Middle East. It's usually exacerbated every single problem and left it worse than it was before.
Sure.
But this situation, I think, now has reached the point that the downsides for everybody, including Europe and European fascism, had tipped the scales.
Well, Graham Fuller, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Ian, for the opportunity.
And again, I've been speaking with Graham Fuller, who's a former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He's lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books, including about the Middle East, including Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East. And his latest book is Breaking Faith, a novel of espionage and an American's crisis of conscience in Pakistan. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.